Today is January 22nd, and we are learning parents and children. We need a Sefer Shmot. Shmot Perek Aleph. That will be page 292. 292 in the Chumashim. Make that 294. We're going to start with Pasuk Tetvav. Page 294. If you're looking at the full Tanakh, you want page... If you're looking at Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tetvav. If you're looking at the full Tanakh... Yes. We should be on page 134. Page 134. Okay. If you have a Chumash, you're on page 294. If you have a Tanakh, page 134. Let's go. Okay. Paro commands in his desire to subjugate the Jews, he commands a removal or a denial of their freedoms. He, in stages, begins to subjugate them, first by charging them with what the text calls Sarei Misim, which is probably tax masters more than task masters. I mean, it's important to know that if you wanted to live in a place where you were not born in the ancient world, you had to pay a special foreigner tax. Maybe you still do.
They have to pay it too also.
So when Paro charged Bnei Yisrael Sarei Misim, it's not dissimilar from what the tax we pay here. I work 2 or 3 or 4 days a week for nothing. I'm not a slave to the government, but they take out of my paycheck what I work. So I don't work for me on those 2 or 3 days. I work for the government. All right. Maybe the Israelites felt a little insulted that we have to pay this foreigner tax. After all, you invited us here. Yosef saved your economy. All right. But after a while, they didn't want to complain, so we'll pay the tax. Then that tax came on the form of backbreaking work. The Torah calls avodat perech. So that backbreaking work, they apparently managed to sustain. Then it became embittered work. Mm-hmm. You can work hard all day, you come home at night, you still have a life. But for which we eat the bitter herbs, the maror at the Seder, that was stage 3, and that began to be something beyond anything they had experienced. What I'm trying to compare this is to the 30s in Germany, where slowly, more rights were taken away, more until there was not just civil rights, or you couldn't sit in the park, or you couldn't be outside past a curfew, or all the Jews were kicked out of school, or out of certain jobs, or couldn't enter certain fields. Paro now is commanding the beginning of genocide, but he doesn't want it to be public knowledge. So he picks upon a certain occupation, the midwife, and he tells the midwives, not just two, the text refers to two girls, two women, Shifra and Pua. These were two women, for instance, Ibn Ezra says, who were in charge of thousands of midwives. Weren't only two midwives who were serving all the Jewish women? No, there were thousands, but these two were put in charge. So let's start with that. King of Egypt told, now your English translation probably reads the Hebrew midwives, right?
Some of the midwives.
Right? Most of the commentaries, Rashi, even the real Pashtunim, Ibn Ezra, Rashbam, Ramban, whether that you think that these midwives can be identified with others, have you ever heard of any Medrash who they were? Yocheved Miriam, right? It's Gemara in Maseches Sota. All right, but every commentary I just mentioned say at least that they were Hebrews. Meldota Ivriot means Hebrew midwives. However, Abravanel, and I'll tell you that there is a Medrash that seems to agree with him, Abravanel says that Meldota Ivriot does not mean Hebrew midwives, it means the midwives of the Hebrews. Paro wouldn't entrust what he wants to have happen here to Jewish women. And Jewish women wouldn't agree to do it. Right? I know that there are terrible stories that the Germans put Jews in charge of very bad things during the war. But if Shifrin, if this is Yocheved and Miriam and they agreed to do this, they only agreed at the outset in order to rebel in the end, right? Which is what they did, right? Okay, but be that as it may, I say there's a Medrash that seems to agree with this because there is a collection in a Medrash. It's not a mainstream Medrash, it's called Medrash Tadshei. It collects 48 righteous Gentiles in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Right? Who was among them? The greatest of them all is Paro's daughter. Mm-hmm. Right? Shifra and Pua are on that list. So according to that Medrash, these are not Hebrews. Mm-hmm. These are Egyptians. Why are they called Mialdota Ivriot? Because they were midwives of the Hebrews. Okay? Okay, anyway, so the text names them, and Paro instructs them, Vayomer, Pasuk Ted Zion, B'yaledchen et ha'ivriot, when you help the Hebrews give birth, Uri'iten al ha'avnayim, and look at the birth stool, Imbeinhu v'hamiten oso. If it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live. Now, Paro's plan at this point is questionable. What's if you want a slave nation, why are you killing boys? You want them to grow up and be more slaves, right? Mm-hmm. So there's two answers to this. One is that he wanted at first to subjugate them and to erase them. He wants the girls, he figures, will assimilate and marry Egyptian men. The boys I'll get rid of now for the time being. And just take a few years, they'll all assimilate, they'll become Egyptians, no more Hebrews. Another opinion is, no, he wanted them as slaves. This is what I'm about to tell you is Rashi. He wanted them as slaves. He's only killing boys for a short period of time. Only a very short period of time. Obviously, Moshe's older brother Aharon didn't have such a problem that we're about to read. Right? This is a very, why such a short period of time? He only killed boys for just a few months.
They told him. The Goel is about to be born.
Right. This is the opening scene, by the way, in the movie The Ten Commandments. Uh-huh. Mamish, the first opening scene where the magicians and soothsayers of Paro tell him that we just saw a vision in the stars that a child has been born in Egypt, right? The Medrash says they weren't even sure if he was an Egyptian or a Hebrew, right? But his child was just born in Egypt, who will be the cause of our ruin. It'll be the destruction of our nation, and it will be a deliverer for these Hebrews. So, because they said they didn't know if he was being raised as a Hebrew or an Egyptian, Vayomer l'chol amo, the decree was for Egyptian boys as well. That's what Rashi says. Okay, I'm not sure if that's the pshat of Vayomer l'chol amo. Vayomer l'chol amo means, until then, Paro was interested in killing Jews, but he wanted to be kept a secret. The Nazis tried, you know, they tried first the euthanasia program, they tried killing people that quietly, right? And then throughout the war, they tried to keep it a secret from the rest of the world, but so much indication that everybody knew. But be that as it may, Paro at first keeps it a secret, just to shh, if you see it's a girl, okay. If it's a boy, you know, strangle him and then tell, oh, look what happened, he came out dead. But afterwards, it was open season. Take the boys and just throw them in the water. Okay, so the magicians told him that we see that child that's born is going to have his downfall at water. That's what we see. He will fall because of something at water. And they were right. Moshe, when he hit the rock to get the water for Bnei Yisrael, that was his downfall. They were almost right. You get it? So,
but there's a text that the Chartumim said this, or you're quoting the text?
Quoting the Medrash? No, there's a Medrash. Yeah. That part I don't think they made it in the movie. Okay, so, all right. So I gave you this introduction just to tell you these five stages of subjugation. First, Sarei Misim, Avodas Parach, Vayemuras Chayehem, the midwife secretly killing the babies, and then public open genocide, Vayemalachol Amo, see the cat's out of the bag, nothing is being kept secret anymore. There are these five stages of subjugation because at the end of the story, there are five stages of redemption. For which we drink four cups of wine at the Seder and we have a fifth cup for Eliyahu. Okay, so now in the face of this, you might understand why, if this is going on for Jewish people, that they're not really interested in procreating. Why should we have children just to be taken from us, to be killed? Right? So, in the midst of this, now this is what relates to our class. Perek Bet. Vayelech ish mi beit Levi. Okay, anyone have it? We're starting chapter 2. Okay. A man went from the house of Levi, vayikach et bat Levi. And he took a daughter of Levi. Vatahar hishav vatelet bein. The woman conceived and gave birth to a son. Vatera oto ki tovhu. She saw that he was good. Vatitzpenehu shlosha yirachim. And she hid him for 3 months. V'lo yachla od hatzpino. And when she could no longer hide him. Vatikach lo tevat gome. Vatachmara b'chemer v'azofet. Vatesem v'tosem et hayelet v'tosem v'sof. V'suf al sfat hayor. So she prepared a small little ark for him, a small little basket, and she prepared it. The Bible is a little painstaking in telling us how she did this, and she put him in amongst the reeds at the banks of the Nile. Okay, let's ask some questions about this. Go look at these three psukim I just read. Tell me some questions you have. Starting with verse 1, just 1, 2, and 3.
Why they will just mention to them it's someone from the house of Levi, they took a daughter of Levi.
Why not tell me the names? Usually when something like this happens, we know who they are later. This is Amram and Yocheved, right? And there are plenty of other stories in the Bible like this. The next pasuk should read, V'shem ha'ish Amram, V'shem ha'isha Yocheved, and etc., etc. Why are you hiding the names of these people? Another question?
Yes. Why do we need to say the Yelech? Why does it say Yikach?
Right.
Why
even
four?
Ibn Ezra, Rabban, you can reconstruct this pasuk to say, Vayikach ish mi beit Levi et bat Levi. What is Vayelech? He went? Yeah. When he went from one place to another? That could just be biblical stylistics, but we'll have to explain that. But what is that extra word, Vayelech? What else?
Were they refraining? Were men and women refraining from having children now? And that's why...
So Rashi moves in that direction because we know that if this couple ends up being the parents of Moshe, this baby is Moshe. We know the story, fine. But but we're about to see in verse 4 that he has an older sister. Why wasn't her birth mentioned? Right? There's a Karaite commentary, by the way, that says, well, maybe she was the child of... Chevet with a different man. This was his half sister. That's nonsense. In Sefer Bamidbar, it says in Parshas Pinchas that Yocheved bore Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe to Amram. So they're all siblings. They're not half siblings. So then that question returns. Why didn't you mention? It says Vayelech ish mi beit Levi, Vayikach et bat Levi. A man went from the house of Levi, married the daughter of Levi. And they had a daughter, they named her Miriam. They had a son, they named him Aaron, right? Those two names, I'll just tell you, are just interesting because Miriam, now Mara in ancient Egyptian means love, like Merari. Levi had a son named Merari. Amor, according to some linguists, comes from this in Romance languages. Right, hitamrubi, hemarto. There's some commentaries that say God showed you love. Okay, be it as it may, but Miriam certainly much more in the Hebrew realm means bitter. Mm-hmm. Miriam is called In fact, the Talmud says that the actual the bitterness of the slavery, the full slavery, only began the year Miriam was born. There were 86 years of the bitterness, of the full bitterness of the slavery. So Aaron, what does Aaron mean in Hebrew? So Aaron, and then this is just, I'm saying a drash now. I did not see this in the Gemara. But Aaron sounds very close to the Hebrew word for pregnancy. Herayon means pregnancy in Hebrew. So Aharon, like Aleph Hey, is an expression of anguish in the Bible. Like A-H, maybe. Right? So Aharon may be, oh no, I'm having another baby. What? First time we had a baby that we got to live, right? But this time, who knows? But all right, but they weren't killing boys yet at this time. But giving birth is a joyful thing if you have a chance to bring this child into a better world than you have. But what am I bringing this child into? What kind of world, right? So now this third child is going to be named by someone else. We'll see. Yes?
Question. Do you think maybe the connection to was the relative of Abraham, Haran? Maybe you have some connection with names? No?
Not familiar with that, but. Yeah. Okay. But this is a very interesting thing. The way that the Bible cares to tell us how his mother prepared this basket in order for him to float in the water. But Shabbos, I know if you have a basket that has any holes in it and you put it down in water, forget it, it's going to sink in 2 seconds. You put a newborn baby in a basket in water? Who's going to think of it? You're trying to save his life, you're going to kill him faster than if the Egyptians got him. Right? So what is she doing? So, okay, we'll let the reader know that she put in pitch and tar and she lined it and she put, right? What does that sound like?
Noah's Ark. Mm-hmm.
In fact, that this whole pasuk here has almost an exact likeness in Parshas Noach with the way he pitched the woods so that water wouldn't seep in. Why is the Bible telling us to? The Bible has to tell me how to make a basket. You just say she prepared it in a way that would float. Who cares? Well, the Bible doesn't tell us how to. It's not a guide. Go to an IKEA guide to see how to make baskets. Why do I need the Bible to do that? So why is it telling me this painstaking? It's not two pages; it's just one verse. But still, it's I like to read the Bible so closely that if you tell me more information than I needed to know, I have to explain it. What do you think?
Northrop Frye, who has 25 lectures on the Bible, compares the Ark of Noah to the Ark of the Covenant to this Ark, and then goes on. What else? Well, he's got a couple other. Arcs.
So I just want to compare the Noah's Ark to this. What would you do? What's the
He point? Goes it all the way because he's a Christian. He compares it to the manger of Jesus' birth, and so
yeah. Okay.
He goes through all the way.
I have, by the way, if you look, if you
and Newark, of course.
No, of course. But if you look at the Midrashim about the birth of Moshe and the room being filled with light, and she sees that he's good. Watch. If he wasn't good, she wouldn't save him. Mm-hmm. Only because he's good, she saves him because it's her son and she loves him.
But no, maybe it means he wasn't sick.
So, all right, so I'm going to tell you that you're hitting on something very big that I wouldn't want to talk about here, but the Midrashim, to talk about what this Vatero Kitovu is very consistent with what's written in the New Testament about the other birth that you just mentioned. But be it as it may, I want to get back to the Ark and this basket. What do you think?
Yeah, perhaps she had to make the basket very special, because the more special looking it was, it would have attracted somebody's attention, like somebody of high rank should be like, oh, such a beautiful package. There has to be something special in it also.
Very interesting. She knows, who's going to find this thing? Another Hebrew? What good is that going to do me? Right? Mm-hmm. Hopefully a compassionate Egyptian will find this.
A woman,
right? And to do something with it, more so because of how elaborate and how beautiful the basket looks. Maybe. I mean, she didn't have to make any inquiry to know that this is a Hebrew. Who's putting babies in baskets now? Right? It must be a Hebrew because of my father's decree. So So I still want to get back to the. I mean, it certainly is a svara. Let's see. I have three more. Let's see, Shana, what do you think?
I'm thinking the comparison with Noah's Ark could be because it was the salvation of the
this woman is saving the world.
Yeah.
She's saving the world right now. Because if this man is going to challenge what the Egyptians are doing, and if this goes unchallenged, I mean, at the Haggadah we say, Harianu, Vanenu, Vne Vanenu, Meshubadim, Ayu, the power of the time, right? At the night of the Seder, we say, if not for what happened in the Exodus story, we'd still be slaves today, which is, you know, a little disingenuous. The Egyptian dynasties had long been lost by then. Well, the Haggadah may be saying, yeah, because if not for what happened in the Exodus story, they would still be as powerful as they are, denying liberty and freedom to many millions of people by today. So okay, that's you know, when you're a slave, all you can think about is survival for that day. Well, I have no incentive to be better. No, well, I just want to get through the day, right? So when the first thing the Torah stresses all over the Sefer Shmos and Parshas Mishpatim especially, is now that you can go beyond survival. Now you can be a human being and help others and help a stranger and remember the people who share your what you experienced. And there are other people who experience the same things. So that's why the fair treatment of the stranger is the most commonly repeated mitzvah in the Torah. Because we were strangers. We started off our existence as a nation as strangers. All right, be that as it may, yes, I think that's what's going on here. The Bible wants to tell us that what this woman is doing is saving the world no less than what Noah was doing. Okay, but I want to get back to some of the earlier questions. Why are we not told about the birth of this child's older sister and older brother? So there are two different opinions on this. One is that because they're just not important. Their birth is not important.
Marriage.
Okay, that's Rashi, but that's the second answer. The first answer is that, okay, this man got married, this couple got married, and I'm not telling you the first two children they had because that's not important right now. Miriam and Aaron's birth is not important. Well, guess what? David's birth also wasn't important. Avraham's birth wasn't important. Noah's birth wasn't important. Yeah, right? Shimshon's birth was important. Shmuel's birth was important. Yitzchak's birth was important. Well, how do I know this? Because the ones I'm told about was important. If it wasn't important, I'm not told about it. Got it? Okay, so the birth of Miriam and Aaron did not make any impression, so it's not mentioned. Don't be surprised. The couple got married, and they had a child. And that's their third child. What about one and two? All right. Don't hit me overhead with that. The Bible doesn't tell me everything in the world. All right, leave some things for your imagination or for the Medrash to help out with. Okay, so that's an oral tradition to help us with what else happened. However, what Mrs. Bistrisky is telling us is that there is another opinion, Rashi, that this is the first birth of this marriage. Right? So you're familiar with the tradition that says that this couple were married, had two children, and then divorced. Mm-hmm. Amram led a troop of men to say, you know what? We can't stay married. We can't bear children. We can't keep doing this, giving birth to children who have nothing to look forward to but the lash. Better not to have children at all. Right? And Miriam convinced Amram to take back the women. This whole unfortunate episode lasted 3 months altogether, right? And he took her back. So vayelach ish mi beis Levi, Igor, that's your drash. Vayelach means holach ba'atzas bito. He went after his daughter's advice, and he remarried, and their first child was this baby. Okay. Ibn Ezra says vayelach just means he traveled from one place to another before marrying her, to which Ramban queries, who cares? I tell you what Vayelech means. The scientific thing to do is to open up a concordance. You all know what that is, right? An alphabetical listing of all the words in the Bible. And look at 20 other places that where a verse begins with the word Vayelech. And they all have one thing in common. And it's the way we talk in English too. Right? Let's go Davin Marav. What does that mean? Take a walk first?
Proceed.
Right?
Go.
Right? L'chuvanim k'renu li'yishma'elim. Let's go and sell him to the Ishmaelites, the brother said about Yosef. Right? Even there are other examples of marriage in the Bible. Vayilech v'yikach es gomer bas divlayim in Hosea. It's an expression of enthusiasm, says Rampan. Will you go and do your homework already? Right? Where do you want me to go? Right? So it's according to Ibn Ezra, a wise guy might want to, you know, ask that question. But Ramban just says it's just an expression of enthusiasm, which means that Ramban is the exact opposite of Rashi on this score. Rashi says that he led a group to divorce the wives. Ramban says, what are you talking about? He enthusiastically embraced the idea of getting married and putting children into such a miserable existence. Maybe one of them will deliver us. There you go. Okay. All right, so she saw that he was good. Rashi says that this is more than just good, and that's what Dr. Sidorsky just mentioned. The Medrash, out of these few words, makes such a tzimis about what she saw. The light, he was circumcised, he was born circumcised, he was healthy, his nails were all formed, and he had hair, and he was good. Right? And if he was ugly, listen, most children are born, you know, I'm sorry, but you look at them for, you know. I was there 6 times. If it's a Caesarean, sometimes they're not, you know, they're not so banged up. But it's so. And if she looks at them, oh, I'm not saving this one. Come on. So what does it mean about Teiro Soki Tofu? So the Medrash says there's something extraordinary going on here. Right. We said this a few months ago when Rivka was experiencing Vayisro Tetsua Banim B'Kirba. So Rashbam just says, okay, she was experiencing birth pains. She didn't even realize she was carrying two. Right? Anyone here ever bear twins? No? Okay, so...
Thank
so,
God.
Getting there.
All right, so... So, all right, one can be painful, two, all right. But Rashi says, no, it's got to be more than that. The Bible isn't in the habit of just telling us what it's like to feel, to be pregnant. It's not. It has to be something that no one else experienced. So you know the Rashi that talks about what the two babies were doing inside of her. All right, so to hear, there's something more than just the ordinary. And she hides him for 3 months. Who cares how long she could hide him? And why didn't she hide him for 4 months? Or 2 months? Just say, she hid him as long as she could, and when she could no longer hide him, who cares how long that is, right?
He was born premature, right?
That's what Rashi says.
Yes, 6 months premature.
Exactly.
Probably it was because she wanted it to be 9 months, right?
Right. So because, this is what all the commentaries say, is that the Egyptians took, they would, on you know, periodically, because otherwise everyone will hide their children. How do we know, right? So the Egyptians would come on regularly scheduled visits to people's homes to see if there's a baby crying, does a woman look pregnant, and so they she beat them by 3 months, and she realized they're coming back soon, so I'd better do something. Okay, that's what Rashi writes. Right, the source of this Rashi is hard to come by. It makes sense. There's another medrash that this is a Gemara actually that says that she was already pregnant at the time he divorced her. Remember, they were separated for 3 months. He didn't know that. But when he remarried her, she was already 3 months pregnant. And then 6 months later, she gave birth to a full-term baby. And then she realized she would have those 3 months afterwards die. Okay, it's just, you know, when the Bible tells you what's called TMI, too much information, which this sounds like, that you can, that's Rashi's interpretation. I think Rashi rejected the Gemara that she was pregnant before this marriage, because verse 2 starts with the word vatahar, which seems to imply that, doesn't seem to apply, it states pretty clearly that she conceived only after this remarriage, if you will, not before. Okay, all right, so when she could no longer hide him, so she took this basket and she prepared it and she put it in the amongst the reeds. Okay. So this girl, who according to the Medrash was responsible for his conception altogether, is now taking responsibility for him and to look after him. Chazal say that because she waited a short little time for Moshe, a time would come in the desert where the whole nation will wait for her. Mm-hmm. Remember what that is?
When she has leprosy.
Right, when she has tzaras, they all waited for her because she waited for Moshe. This is a Mishnah in Masechet Sota. So, and she runs into the daughter of Paro. Okay, now, this is surreal. Where does a slave girl, I mean, Miriam is only 5 years older than Moshe, but let's say, all right, however, she's a little precocious, but where does a slave girl have the chutzpah to actually walk face to face and speak to her? And the average Egyptian on the street would spit in the face of a slave before you can talk, address them directly. And so it is showing in its innocence, because the story is, it's almost, as it appears, almost hard to believe. How does a 5-year-old get up even anywhere close to where the daughter of the king is bathing and washing? How did she ever get in there? Right? So it's just the point is just the sheer humanity. This is a girl who's clearly looking after this basket. It's probably her brother, right? And you could probably picture all the, daughter of a king probably doesn't bathe alone. She's probably got, people around her. I'm going to say, her name was Bitya, Batya, according to the Medrash, and in the movie too, by the way. So she's Batya. This is a slave girl. What are you even talking to? He goes, let's hear what she has to say. There's some overriding humanity. Now, I go back to where I started. The Egyptians worked hard at getting the average Egyptian to hate the Jews. There is a line like that. Vayakutsu mipnei b'nei Yisrael. They started to hate the Jews. Right? They trained, the people the propagandists.
Dehumanize
the Jew. If you look at some early speeches, I'm not telling somebody to read Mein Kampf by any means, but the main reason for the war against the Jew was because the Jew will not allow us to attain our 1,000-year Reich, because we have to do certain things to society that the Jew will not allow, and Hitler spells it out. Guilt, morality, they will not allow us to do what we want to do. We want to wipe out the weaker. People who don't contribute to society, only take from society, will be killed off. We will not allow their genes to be spread to another generation. So the first one after the euthanasia program on the weaker ones, right? So the amazing contrast of this is the Torah is telling us, Like we know that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Your house is only as safe as its weakest lock, right? So what we want to do is look after the weaker ones in society, and maybe spend an inordinate amount of effort in helping those weaker ones. That's what comes out of this story. So there's a certain humanity that transcends all of Paro's wickedness and all of Vayakutsu mipnei b'nei Yisrael. And look, I'm sorry to say that there were plenty of stories, and there's a whole forest at Yad Vashem for what we call the righteous Gentiles. But look, the Nazis made good examples of any Pole or Romanian or Hungarian or anyone who helped a Jew. A Pole caught helping a Jew would be killed, and his whole family hanged in the town square. A German harboring a Jew would maybe lose their job. They'd shave their hair and walk in the street with a placard that says, "I love Jews." They didn't kill Germans who hid Jews. They killed Poles and others. But so all right. But this righteous Gentile, this daughter of Paro, is about to address a 10-year-old Hebrew girl. Let's see how it appears. So, as she opens up this ark, look at verse 6. Vatiftach batirehu esayelet. She opened it up and saw him, and it was a child. And now she says, V'hinei na'ar bocheh. The word yeled can describe a three-month-old baby, but na'ar doesn't. How old do you have to be called a na'ar? I got to tell you, there's a 56-year-old man in the Torah called a na'ar. Who is that? Anybody know? Yehoshua.
Who?
Yehoshua, at the age of 56 in Parshas Kisisa, is called na'ar. Yosef at 17 is called na'ar. Yirmiyahu, in his first prophecy, says, I can't speak, ki na'ar anochi. He may be very young there. But be it as it may, who is this na'ar who's crying? He named na'ar bocha. So, Beheshev Rabbi the Chosid says, she heard Aaron crying. Aaron was crying because his brother was taken from him. Right? See, all the problems with the brothers back in Sefer Bereishit is now being fixed because, you know, Aaron recognizes already at this tender age that my younger brother is destined for something great, but look what they're doing to him. They took him out of the house. And 80 years later, when they meet for the next time, right, when he's 83 and Moshe's 80, Hashem has to tell Moshe, listen, Moshe, stop pushing off my your calling. I know what you're worried about. You're worried about what this means to your brother. He's back home doing all the work, and for one day, walked out to see what the suffering is like. And just one day you spent, and then you ran away. Right? And now you come back all these years later, and now you're in charge? I know, Moshe, you're worried about your brother's feelings. So that's why God tells Moshe, don't worry, he's already on his way to meet you, and he's happy for you. Why do you have to tell me that? What does the Bible have to say? Just say, Aaron's coming. He's going to tell you what to do. He's going to take you back and get things started. But Moshe needed to know that my brother is not jealous the way Esav was jealous of Yaakov, or the way Yishmael was jealous of Yitzchak, or the way Yosef's brothers were jealous of him, with the trend of younger brothers, you know, outdoing their older siblings throughout the Bible. I think I might have told you when we're doing this in Bereishis, Winston Churchill wrote a book chronicling the siblings of all the kings of England. Not the kings themselves, the siblings. And he made a listing. They have these archives. And he did the research to show that in his opinion, but that was the point of his book, in every generation, I guess it was safe for him to do so in his time, there was a younger sibling who would have made a better king or queen than the one who actually ruled as king. Why? Because when you are born from your first day, and because of your age, you are set aside from day one to be king, and all you say every day is, I just can't wait to be king, right? You will not be a good king. It's the younger ones who have to compete for who's going to be number two, who's going to be the Duke of York, and who's going to be the Duke of Nottingham, and who's going to... Healthy competition to make yourself better all your life, you'll be a better person.
Right? It's even King's Speech, you know, the movie. You know?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
She's your...
Okay, so
the yes. fact that this young girl, however old she is, can go and talk to the daughter of Pharaoh, it shows some prominence in that family. And similar to, like, Bayela Kadish. You know, there seems to be some amount of prominence.
I'm not sure if she knows who she's talking to. I'm not sure, but
she's in the video.
Could be. It could be then. It could be.
And Moshe and Aaron get similar due respect throughout the whole rest of the story.
What about now? You questioned that.
So it's talking about Aaron. Aaron was the one crying.
Yeah, I understand. But what about the Nar about Moshe?
The Nar isn't Moshe.
Yelled.
So he was also there? No, no, he was crying back home.
So he was also there?
No, he was crying back home. I don't know, Vinay doesn't mean that she's hearing it. It just means she's telling us a fact. I'm just telling you that's the parish of Yudah Chassid. Don't ever be surprised by what you see in Yudah Chassid. It's always a chiddush. All right, So she had pity, and she said, oh, this must be your child. You think? Who else is putting children in like this, right? But Tomar Achoso Abaspar. So she had the chutzpah to raise her voice, and she said, listen, if I don't speak up now, forget it. So she said, "Can I find a nursemaid? Because, you know, let's us girls talk. You know, whoever you are, it's a real pain to raise a baby this age. I can take care of that for you, and I'll bring him back when he's fine. When it'll be a little easier to raise him, right? Okay, so that's what she does, and she does such a good deal. She even gets the mother to get paid for it, right? Okay, so in Pasuk Yud it says Vayigdal Hayeled, Vatzviyelu Bas Paro Vayhilo Lebein, Vatikroshma Moshe Vatomer Kmina Mayim Mishisil. So how old is Moshe at this time? It says Vayigdal Hayeled. He grew up, and she brought him to Bas Paro. Who? Who brought him to Bas Paro? What do you say, Miriam?
No,
the
mom.
Yocheved. They say in the movie the actors couldn't pronounce her name, so they called her Yoshebel. In the movie, they couldn't say, they wanted to say Yocheved, so they couldn't say the ch sound, so they changed her name in the movie to Yoshebel. Right. Actually, I was once speaking to a large group of secular Jews, giving them a little bit of like rebuke about that they're not fluent in Jewish thought and in Jewish information. And I said, how many people here know the birthday of Moses? And not one person in the room. There was about 400 people, not one person. So how many people in this room know the birthday of Jesus? So, but by the way, Christian theologians say it's very wrong also. But anyway, all right. But be that as it may, but they all claim to know the second one. Just okay. How many know the mother of Jesus? And they all say, well, yeah, we know. She said, how many of you know the mother of Moses? So one guy calls out from the back of the room, I know, it's Yoshebel. Okay, so it could be because our verse does not tell us who is the subject of this verb vatzviyehu, but it's more likely that it's not the child. Maybe, I don't know. The child should go back and say, "Remember me? I was that person. Remember?" I don't know. He says, "Listen, we know what this is about. It was my daughter. It's very painful to give up her son, but you know what?" That's what, how many Jews in Europe had to do this? They knew they gave up their children on the kinder transports, right? So she's giving up her son. And it could be, I think if the mother is the subject of Vitzviyehu, the Bas Paro, Vayehi lo, Vayehi means he became to her a son. You know how you say son in ancient Egyptian?
Moshe.
Not Moshe, yeah. But Moses. Moses. Like Ramses means the son of Ra. Ramses. So Mases means son. But to draw from water in ancient Egyptian. Ramses means son of Ra. Mases means son.
Mases?
Is son. So, but to draw from water, Ibn Ezra tells us in ancient Egyptian, he says, means manes. Manes. So it's a diminutive of Moshe. Moshe Manes. Have you heard of the name Manes? Yeah. It's very interesting. But I don't know if the source of that name is from Ibn Ezra or not. But the reason why we say this is because it's hard to fathom that in some kind of fit of prophetic pique, Paro's daughter all of a sudden started speaking Hebrew. Right. That's the problem in the movie also. And because I drew you from the water, I shall name you Moses. Call him Andrew or Drew or something like that. Or draw. What are you calling him Moses because you drew him from water? Right? At least put a little asterisk at the sign. This is in Hebrew, by the way.
But didn't she convert?
Later.
This is some later, the Talmud says, yes. She joined us. She left Egypt with us. So, and then the movie too, by the way. She joins Moshe's Seder in the movie. There's a lot of nonsense in the movie because it's Hollywood, but there's a lot of good stuff there too. Okay, so So to say that she named him Moshe because I drew him from the water. Now, okay, the Rabbi Yehuda Chassid on this says the person naming Moshe is the one bringing him. But she's not the one who drew him from the water.
Maybe it's a slave woman? Because she sent her Amma to bring the...
Rabbi Chassid wants to say it's a Hebrew speaker naming him.
Yeah.
So she didn't actually draw him from the water. She could perhaps say, because I made the basket that saved you, I drew you from the water. I don't know. Yosef's brothers didn't sell Yosef. They were not the ones who pulled him out of the pit to sell him to the Midianites. The Ishmaelites did that. And yet, at the end of the story, Yosef says, don't be upset that you sold me to the Egyptians. They didn't sell him. That's Rashbam. So here too. I know I didn't physically draw you from the water, but because I made the... I'm just trying to explain how all of a sudden she's... Why would she start speaking Hebrew all of a sudden? Mm-hmm. She named him an Egyptian. The name Moshe the name that we call Moshe in the Bible is a Hebraized form of what she did to him.
Yeah.
Right? It's also questionable because... Sforno says that the name should have been Mashui. Mm-hmm. Mashui means, sounds a little funny, but it means drawn from water. Moshe means will draw others from water. So another prophetic vision that he will draw others from the water, like we'll read in this week's parsha, mm-hmm. Right? Okay, fair enough. Okay, so Moshe grew up. So how old is he? How old do you want him to be?
If you could compare to Abraham, when they say Vayigamal Hanaar, it says maybe 3 or 4 years old.
It doesn't say Vayigamal. Well, okay, if the whole purpose was, she said, to nurse this child,
yes.
Right? So children nursed till 2 at that time. Okay, so he's beginning of his 3rd year right now. Mm-hmm. Just turned 2. Okay, so then when it comes to the next pasuk, Vayihi Bayamim Ahem, Vayigdal Moshe. This is a much greater Vayigdal. He's older than 2, for sure. Vayetze elechov vayar besiv losam. Wait a second, there's something missing here. How does he know? How does he know who he is?
Yes.
Ramban asks that question here. In the movie, it's very clever how he figures out that he's a Hebrew.
Yes.
But Ramban just says, the Bible doesn't care to tell us that. Someone told him. How do you find? I don't know. Now, according to Ramban, that's a question because he says that he was 2 when he was brought there. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have any recollection of what was before. They knocked that out of his head. He doesn't remember any of it. All right? Okay. Rashi says he was 13 when he was brought. So if you're 13, you know, you have memories, you have recollections, you know who your brother is, you know who your siblings are, right? Okay, but so this is where we'll continue with next week. And the idea of Miriam being the one who is responsible for Moshe's birth is seems to be why she behaves with respect to Moshe in a particular story we'll get to, if not next week, the week after. As someone who's a little too doting about Moshe's married life. And if she has something to say about what Moshe's married life is like, right, she should talk to Moshe, not to Aaron about that. You all know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so we'll get to that. And we still have a few other things to talk about here, if I can give you a homework assignment. Starting with verse 11. Okay? Starting with verse 11 to the end of the chapter, I would like to introduce you to a concept that Nechama Leibowitz introduced. It's called Milat Mancha. Milat Mancha, which means every story, our story now is Moshe's emergence onto the stage of humanity. He's going to save our story. There is a word, milat mancha, a word that transcends the story. It has to be a word that is used at some point you'll feel unnecessarily. It's extraneous. I didn't need this word. I didn't need it once. I certainly don't need it seven times. It's a word that keeps on appearing and appearing and appearing, and that word generally defines the story. So look for that word for next week. We'll start with that. Okay? And it's nice to see you again because I was in Israel and we were gone for some time. Welcome back to Shana. She was also in Israel for an extended stay. Welcome back. 4 months. Wow.
How long?
4 months.
And we have better weather.
Yes.
No freezing.
Not Marv freezing.
Next door.
And we have Marv next door.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.